This week in the news, a case study in the Robin Hood tax, Texas pensions could be taking us the way of Illinois, and there's wealth redistribution going on at Texas's flagship university. In our interview, we talked to State Senator Bob Hall about a critical issue of national security, and we close with a commentary from Michael Quinn Sullivan. Welcome back, friends, to another week of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. We'll get started this week with the news, talking to Ross Kessig in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. Ross, you've done a little bit of a case study on Robin Hood and how that impacts people's property taxes, and it's pretty startling. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Plano ISD, the city of Plano, is one of the largest suburbs in North Texas, and since Robin Hood was enacted by lawmakers in 1994, data shows that Plano ISD taxpayers have paid over $1.7 billion in Robin Hood taxes, which are property taxes that Plano ISD taxpayers pay, but they don't stay in Plano ISD schools. They're actually recaptured by the state and sent to help fund other school districts around the state.
Yeah, so under this Robin Hood property tax system, and this is going on all over the state, you have people paying property taxes in, and they think, hey, I'm paying these taxes, and they're going to my local schools. But in reality, there's some central accounting that goes on by the state, and that money is picked up and then taken somewhere else.
Yeah, more than 200 school districts in Texas currently pay the Robin Hood tax. They pay money into the system. They pay property taxes that some of which goes to the local schools, but some of which is actually taken and redistributed elsewhere. And so just to look at the typical, how this has impacted homeowners. So due to the Robin Hood tax and massive bond debt that the local school board has issued, the typical homeowner in Plano ISD has seen their school property tax bill increase 84% in 10 years.
Wow, wow. So almost double over the last decade because of this scheme that's going on. This has a tremendous effect on property values. It actually was an interesting study a few years back by the Heartland Institute that said this scheme destroys property wealth. Basically, people don't like paying taxes that don't go back to their own community.
Yeah, I think it's one thing if you pay high taxes to have your kids go into a, quote, better school district or whatever. But what a lot of people don't realize is if the Robin Hood tax was repealed by state lawmakers, they would pay lower school taxes. And the school district their kids go to would still get the same amount of funding. So they're really being overtaxed more than what they should in order to fund the schools their kids go to.
Yeah, effectively, it's an illegal, unconstitutional statewide property tax.
That's absolutely right.
Thank you for your reporting on it. I encourage listeners to go check it out on texasscorecard.com. Something that's going on around the state that everybody ought to be paying attention to. Thanks for that, Ross. Next, let's turn to Sal Ayala, policy analyst with Empower Texans. Sal, you're putting up some alarm bells about property tax increases coming as a result of pension problems. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing and what we might have to worry about here in the Lone Star State.
Sure thing, Tony. Well, just to be clear, nobody's proposing a new property tax here in Texas just yet, but this kind of appeared on my radar when I saw a story out of Chicago where there was an event, a pension event, put on by the Civic Federation, and one of the presenters presented a proposal for a new special property tax in Illinois to address five of their pension funds, which are really underwater. They have a large accrued unfunded liabilities.
Yeah, basically, the state of Illinois, like pretty much every state in the nation, but particularly the state of Illinois, they have promised all of their employees, hey, we're going to give you all of these benefits, and they really don't have a way to pay for them. So they're saying, hey, how do we pay for this? Well, of course, we just go and raise property taxes. That's the proposal there.
Right, basically. And so I started digging into some of Texas's numbers, and I came across, first of all, there was a 2016 Moody's report which placed four Texas cities in the top 15 for unfunded liabilities in terms of pensions. And there was also a Fiscal Times report that put Houston and Dallas near the top in terms of nation's worst municipal finances.
Yeah, I mean, people here in Texas have this misconception. They think, oh, this is a conservative state. This is a Republican state. And sure, your state government is run that way. But as everybody knows, the city council, the county commissioners, people in Houston, Harris County, Dallas, Fort Worth, those areas, not less Fort Worth, but we'll talk about Fort Worth in a minute. But in all these places, you have these very liberal city councils who are spending and spending and spending without the resources really to pay for it. And it's getting noticed by international, you know, credit rating groups.
Yeah, absolutely, Tony. And so this is an issue that not only affects our municipalities, but, you know, it also affects Texas as well, because we have rather large pension funds that are managed by the Pension Review Board. I looked at some of the numbers there, and one of the most problematic pension systems in the state is the employees' retirement system. It has the largest unfunded liabilities of any of the 93 funds that are managed by the Pension Review Board, and their funded ratio is right around 70% and dropping. And so it's widely considered healthy for pension funds to maintain somewhere above 80% in terms of the funded ratio. And ERS
as well. So they're way below that. Yep. This problem is getting worse month after month, right?
Yeah, it is. And so just looking at the last six-month period from the numbers by the Pension Review Board shows that in the last six-month period, they've added about $3.7 billion in unfunded liabilities, which is about 6 or 7% over 6 months.
So about 6% over 6 months. That's a huge, huge impact. The reality, what we're seeing here and what we can learn from other states is if we don't get on top of this pension problem, which is kind of not a boring issue, it's an accounting thing, but if we don't get on top of this issue, we're not going to be able to make the progress that Texans want to see on tax cuts, on property tax reform, on those things. We're going to be talking about tax increases if we don't nip this in the bud.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a time when you know, conservative activists and leaders around the state are talking about eliminating property taxes, we're seeing Illinois possibly introducing a new special property tax. You know, another thing is the Comptroller's website lists some of the reasons why Texas has maintained its good credit rating despite some of the pension issues that we have, and they talk about, you know, the fiscal discipline of the state, addressing potential future budget gaps in a timely manner, and things of that nature. So, you know, the conservative budgeting that this state has maintained over the last couple of sessions is really important to maintain our AAA credit rating.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Well, thanks for putting up the alarm bells. Thanks for reporting on this. I hope that people are listening.
Yeah, me too, Tony. Thanks a lot.
Next, let's turn to Saurabh Sharma, intern here at Empower Texans. I would say welcome to the movement, maybe welcome to the madhouse here with Empower Texans, but you're a movement guy coming out of Young Conservatives of Texas over at UT, and I wanted to have you in to talk about some policy over at the university, the state's flagship university that taxpayers ought to know about.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing some of the stuff that the University of Texas at Austin, what should supposedly be the pride and joy of our state, can get up to.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so what we wanted to talk about is they are imposing some basically wealth redistribution schemes through financial aid at the same time that they're increasing costs for everyone. Tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. So back in March, the university actually announced a tuition increase that would enact itself over multiple stages over the course of the next few semesters, totaling up to a 10% tuition increase for some students. And in April, the university president, President Greg Fenves, actually, he announced that the university is now going to guarantee a free education to any student whose family makes less than $30,000 per year, if not extra stipends on top of that. But more concerning is a new policy where any family that makes under $100,000 of family income over the course of a year is now possibly entitled to financial aid from the university if they can demonstrate any sort of financial need.
Yeah, and so $100,000, I mean, this is, as you were pointing out, this is 80% of Texas families.
Sure. It basically is. And so you kind of look at the timeline on this. So a tuition increase goes into effect in March. And then in April, they announced this new financial aid. And you can't help but wonder, well, isn't this just textbook wealth redistribution where, okay, we're going to levy new fees on all students, except it's not all students because we're going to give all this free money to most of the students.
Yeah, basically you increase the cost across the board, but then you giveth and taketh away kind of at the same time. And you say, okay, but then I'm going to tinker with it all over the place with this financial aid. And so basically we engage in price discrimination on the price of tuition. How much does it cost? What's a typical cost of semester for the average student at UT?
Yeah, so it varies a little bit depending on which school you go to. You know, some of the business majors, for instance, pay a little bit more because their education is probably more valuable than some of the wackier majors out there. But it ranges between about $5,000 and $5,500 per semester per student, typically.
Yeah, and so we're looking at $500 an increase going into the next couple of years. So a pretty big increase on that. And then, of course, tinkering around the edges in this wealth redistribution scheme. Thanks for joining us, Rob. Thanks for your reporting on this.
Thanks, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to welcome on Texas Scorecard Radio this week, Texas State Senator Bob Hall. Senator Hall, thank you for joining us.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for having me on. I very much appreciate this, and thank you for all that you do.
Yeah, well, thank you. But I wanted to talk to you about an issue. It doesn't necessarily get the most attention out there from folks, but it's an important issue of national security, of prosperity, of securing our future here in the Lone Star State, and that's the issue of hardening our electrical grid against threats, both of natural disaster, but also of man-made disaster. And you've been kind of an expert on that, and so I wanted to bring you on to talk about it. You carried legislation over the last couple sessions on this issue. What's the problem? What are we talking about? I mean, maybe people aren't even aware. You know, electrical grid. Obviously, we know what electricity is, kind of. But educate us a little bit. What's the problem? What's the fear that you're trying to address?
Okay, well, let me put it in perspective of why it's important to protect the grid, and that is that our society has moved in the direction of being so dependent on electricity for our way of life today, as opposed to what it was back in the 1800s prior to having electricity, or even the early 1900s, and where electricity was nice, but it was a luxury item.
Sure.
Today, it's an absolute necessity, because you take away our electricity, it's the third most important thing to sustaining life. Take it away, and the two things that are more important are air and water. Electricity comes ahead of food. There'll be people who live longer without food than they will without electricity. And so having a reliable electrical source is an absolute must. And we've recognized that in the past when we used to have a lot of power outages with storms and minor accidents and things like that. The state stepped up and said, you know, our economy demands reliable electricity. Well, this is just another step towards providing reliable electricity. And this would be in face of a hostile attempt to take away our electricity. And the really unfortunate part is the attempt of taking it away through either an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, which would be a man-made threat. There's also a natural threat of solar activities that could take away our electricity. And it would be done so, it could very well be that it would be a permanent removal. And that is, it would be so badly destroyed, we would be unable to actually repair it and put it back.
I mean, it's a grave issue. I mean, our food our systems, where we get our food, where we, how we run our water, how we, you know, heat ourselves, cool ourselves, run medical devices, all of these things reliant on reliable electricity, something we just kind of take for granted in today's society. But, you know, that is really this huge human achievement over the last century. And this is at risk. If it goes away, you could see people, you know, starving to death, rioting in the streets. I mean, it could be complete chaos. So how would this happen? What is the risk? So we have a grid. It's, you know, I think everybody kind of understands there's electrical lines. So, you know, they see the line that's there in their neighborhood, pole to pole, transformer to transformer, right? And then, you know, they're driving around. They see all the power lines, the major, you know, transmission lines that are out there. They understand that there's power plants that produce the electricity. This is the grid, right? This is the infrastructure that's in place. What's the risk? What actually could happen that would disable all of this transmission of electricity?
Actually, Tony, it is relatively simple, but we've got to go back to people understanding America and its defenses. We have forever considered America invincible. We haven't had a battle on our shores since 1812 war. And we've always thought of the only way someone will take down America would be a huge army from Russia or China with a large nuclear exchange. Well, as our technology has advanced and nuclear weapons have proliferated throughout the world, where not just China and Russia now have them, but we have rogue nations like North Korea and Iran, and even terrorist groups that could get their hands on a nuclear weapon. I mean, we still don't know what happened to 20-plus nuclear weapons from the Soviet Union when it collapsed.
Right.
But we're in an environment where it would not take a huge exchange of nuclear weapons or a large army. We're talking about an attack on America that's a one-time event with one small nuclear weapon that could easily be launched with a medium-range missile off the back of a cargo ship sitting off the coast of Galveston. All it needs to do is get to somewhere between 50 and 250 nautical miles above the Earth's surface over the central part of the United States, say Nebraska, Kansas, not very accurate, and detonate. Now, when that happens, we would not know it. There would be no kinetics. There would be no physical destruction. There would be no people killed. There would be no buildings destroyed. We wouldn't even know it would happen, except that everything electrical or electronic would instantly cease to operate. It would be instantly wiped out.
And how does that work? I mean, it causes a surge through the system? What happens?
Yeah, what happens is when you get outside the atmosphere, the only thing that happens is that explosion throws off a huge amount of gamma rays. And those gamma rays, when they get back to the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere, they impinge on the particles in the atmosphere and knock the electrons off the atoms, just knock them loose off the atoms. And in doing so, they then interact with the Earth's magnetic field. And the Earth's magnetic field causes them to start to swirl and spin, and that is like that's how you generate electricity. So it generates huge surges of electricity. Actually, there are three pulses that come as a result of this interaction, and that would then induce large currents, several thousand volts per meter, into anything metal are electrical operating, and different pulses would affect our electrical system. One of the other pulses affects things that are electronic, like our telephones, our TVs, communications, radios, and things like that, and overloads them quicker than conventional surge detectors can stop them.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we end up doing is burning up way more equipment than we have the physical capacity or have the physical resources to replace them, even if we could. But remember, when I say everything electrical or electronic, that means if you have an automobile that's later in about 1975, it's right. not going to run.
Right. And so you would have all of these things going wrong with not just the devices, but your electrical substations, your, you know, just everything involved in the electrical system. And I guess I wanted to touch on this. It's not just a threat of hostile, you know, an act of war, a military attack. I know I've heard some talk that there was a solar flare back in the 1800s so big that it caused some of these effects. At that time, that was of minimal effect because it's just hitting telegraph lines and those kind of things, but would have had a devastating effect had it happened today. And so this is something that could happen, you know, naturally as well.
Oh, it is. And that wasn't the only time. I mean, that was 1859. It was called a Carrington event. And it was so intense that it burned up our telegraph system from coast to coast and in Europe, sent operators to the hospital, and was so intense that it set railroad ties on fire and warped railroad tracks to look like pretzels. If that were that, if a solar flare of that intensity were to hit today, it would wipe out our electrical grid system. Wow. Completely.
So obviously this is a very important thing. What can be done though? What can be done? You know, obviously this is a problem. We have an electrical system. We're reliant on it. Is there a way to actually harden that system to make it so that it wouldn't collapse if a disaster like this were to occur?
Oh, absolutely. We know exactly. I mean, this phenomenon, we've known about this for over 50 years. And there, we know what it takes to protect our electrical grid. Matter of fact, there are several countries today that are already protecting their grid. Israel, China, Russia, Arab Emirates, we know they have moved out to protect their electrical grid. It's pretty straightforward. We're talking about basically slightly sophisticated surge protectors, grounding, and Faraday cages. They're not complicated. We know how they work. It's just a matter, and they would be scalable solutions for the larger items, the transformers, generating stations, all the way down to what we need to protect businesses and residents.
Yeah.
And it's being done today, so we know what to do, and it's relatively inexpensive. I mean, you think about the fact that we have squandered or spent over $7 billion of taxpayer money to build transmission lines so we can bring the very expensive electricity generated by wind from out west Texas to the metropolitan areas. We're talking about something that probably to protect Texas, roughly in the neighborhood of maybe $2 billion.
Okay. And so less than we're spending on all these green energy boondoggles.
Well, the really big point, and I want to try to get this in before we run out of time, Tony, is think about Texas likes to spend money trying to encourage businesses to come here. I used to say bribe them, but I'll say encourage them to come here.
Bribe is sometimes a good word for it, but that's another discussion for another day.
That is. But think about the economic benefit of the word getting out that Texas is hardening its grid. If there were to be either a natural or man-made event, the lights on in Texas would be back on first, or they would be out the shortest period of time. I can't think of anything we could possibly do to attract businesses or families, people that want to protect their families, to move to Texas that would be any greater than that in light of the where we are with this threat today that has been voiced many times by the leaders of North Korea and Iran and the terrorist groups as the way to take down America.
Yeah. And so you'll be back at this next, I assume, next legislative session, assuming you're reelected, of course, got a November election, of course. But if you're back in the legislature in the spring, this will be another priority again. And I guess because we're Texas, we have our own grid, right? So we have an opportunity to lead the nation on this issue. Tell listeners real quick, as we're running out of time, tell listeners where they can learn more about the issue and where they can learn more about your efforts to pass legislation on the issue.
Okay, then go to our website, SenatorBobHall.com, all spelled out, SenatorBobHall.com. I have several articles that are on the website that you can read about. I've written over the last 4 years. You can also sign up to get our newsletter because I continue to write about this on a regular basis to make sure people are informed of what's happening in other places as other states start to recognize this threat and are starting to take legislative action. Texas is starting to lag behind those, and you can find out about it by following us. I have a Facebook page, Senator Bob Hall. We speak about it there on occasion. But the best place is our website, SenatorBobHall.com. Sign up for our newsletter and read those that are up there now.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on and telling us about this, and look forward to seeing what progress you'll make next year on this issue.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your interest and support, and I hope we'll come back again and give you an update once the session starts, if you'd like.
Great. Sounds like a plan. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Have you heard about the Texas Torchbearers Program? It's a program that makes activism fun and exciting. You can sign up at TexasTorchbearers.com. There, you can learn about the easiest and most effective ways to engage your government officials to hold them accountable. As a Texas Torchbearer, you can earn cool prizes like an awesome pair of custom-fit cowboy boots with the Texas Torchbearer logo on it, or even a beautiful custom-engraved 9mm Glock handgun. Sign up today at TexasTorchbearers.com.
The Democrats' blue wave is looking like more of a ripple. Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us more in this week's commentary.
Every 2 years, we hear breathless analysis from media hacks about Democrats retaking Texas. Will 2018 finally be the year Democrats in the Lone Star State surf a blue wave to victory? With a Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. So how about it? Is the much-hyped blue wave poised to wash away Texas Republicans? Leading into the March primary, the New York-based liberal media and their lackeys in Texas were reporting that Democrats were going to see a record-setting turnout in the primary. The result was historically insignificant. This will give you an idea. There were 1,322,724 votes cast for U.S. Senator Ted Cruz in the primary, where he had four challengers. Meanwhile, Robert Francis O'Rourke, the Democrats' nominee, only got 644,632 votes in a field of just three candidates. Cruz himself got more votes than all the Democrats combined, and he received four times as many as O'Rourke. I guess if you squint, it might look like a blue wave from the new syndicate's office overlooking the Hudson Bay, but in Texas, it was barely a ripple. While it runs contrary to the soothing fairy tale Democrats tell their children at night, the Donkey Party isn't gaining traction in Texas. Both parties saw a rise in the primary participation from the 2014 midterm election. While anything can, and usually does, happen between the post-primary dog days of summer and the heady days of the general election, there's little evidence for a blue wave, a blue ripple, or even a blue trickle. It doesn't mean there won't be, of course, but it doesn't look likely. The real excitement is with the conservatives. Democrats have spent the last decade trying to play in the Republican primary. This year was no different. What was different is that a single conservative incumbent lost their primary, not a one. Meanwhile, conservatives continued the trend of steady gains, chipping away at the seats held by Democrat-enabling Republicans. Texas newspaper reporters and editorial writers don't want to see it because it doesn't fit the narrative their New York City owners want to believe. But as our nation's third president once said, facts are stubborn things. The final proof will come sometime after 7 p.m. on Tuesday, November the 6th. But for now, the fantasized blue wave has run up against the red wall of reality. For that wall to remain firm, though, Texas conservatives cannot take the election for granted and must work all the harder to reinforce the Lone Star State as a bulwark against liberalism. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with a Texas Scorecard radio commentary.
You know, Michael's right. As Kerry Cheshire and I discussed last week on the program, the turnout in the Democratic gubernatorial runoff was the lowest that it had been since 1920. That's when Texas had fewer than 5 million citizens. If that's any indication, then we have nothing to fear.
Well, thanks for listening. That's all I've got for you this week. Join us back here next week for another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.